Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the future hold for Iraq now that just 50,000 U.S. troops remain in the country, fewer than at any time since the invasion of 2003? After controversial elections earlier this year, U.S. authorities have proposed a power-sharing deal that would keep Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in office, but give his top rival, Ayad Alawi, control over national security policy. So far, Iraqis have yet to embrace the suggestion. So what will it take for the country to move forward as a stable, unified democracy, and what additional help can the U.S. State Department provide? The Honorable Ryan Crocker is here to talk about it. He is Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University and was U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2007 until 2009. Before that appointment, Crocker had served as Ambassador to Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Ambassador Crocker, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
You have said that we need strategic patience in dealing with Iraq as we move forward. What does that mean?
To understand that clocks in places like Iraq move much more slowly than clocks in Washington or Dallas. That we're an impatient people. It's what built this country. We want to get her done by tomorrow or the day after at the latest. And in places like Iraq, that just isn't possible. So my constant message is we've paid a lot in blood and treasure to take things this far in Iraq. What we have to do is stay engaged in the years to come at a lesser level with lesser costs, but the price of disengaging too soon could be catastrophic.
4,400 U.S. lives so far, an estimated 70,000 Iraqi lives. Does our impatience leave the Iraqis with more than they can handle?
That's a great point, because what we saw in polls about 10 days ago was very striking. 70% of Americans, according to a CBS poll, thought Iraq wasn't worth it, we never should have done it, and we should just get out now. That same week, a poll of Iraqis found that exactly the same percentage, 70%, thought that a U.S. withdrawal would be a mistake. So again, for all that we have paid, all that Iraqis have paid, I think it's important that we make good on that investment for them and for ourselves.
What are the chances that the Iraqis will officially request that U.S. troops remain in larger numbers beyond the 2011 cutoff?
I think there is a good chance they'll do that. When a new government is formed, I would not at all be surprised if late this year they will come to us and say, you know, that security agreement that idiot Crocker negotiated back in 2008 that called for all U.S. forces to be out at the end of 2011, let's take another look at that. And if they do, and it will have to be their initiative, I very much hope we will be receptive.
Does that make it easier, given the current political climate, for the president to consider such a request?
Well, I think, frankly, it's really about casualties. If we're in a situation where young Americans are not being killed, then I think the American people would be receptive to an argument that it is in our strategic interest to stay. Korea would be an example. We have had tens of thousands of troops in Korea for more than half a century, yet it draws really no notice and causes no issues back here in America. So I think that kind of scenario would be palatable in terms of domestic politics.
To what extent do you think that the current action to remove U.S. troops in large numbers from Iraq is, in fact, motivated by domestic political reality?
Well, that's a question for domestic commentators. Clearly, it's a factor. But there are some other very real factors, too, which is the strain on the force. Mm-hmm. We are ramping up in Afghanistan, also the right thing to do, in my view. But in order really to accomplish that without putting unacceptable stress on our ground forces, you do need to ramp down in Iraq. And I've been following closely what our military commanders have been saying. General Odierno, before he left, said he was comfortable with going down to the 50,000 level by the end of August. And if he's comfortable, I'm comfortable.
So how does the exit of so many U.S. troops change the role of the State Department in Iraq?
Well, Well, we're going through multiple transitions. Transitions from a U.S. lead in security to an Iraqi lead that's already accomplished. But we're also moving from a dominant military presence for the U.S. and Iraq to a dominant civilian presence, where the State Department and the other civilian agencies will have the lead. Like security, this has to be a gradual process. You can't just have a sudden handover by the military to the civilians and expect it to work. There are huge capacity issues. The entire U.S. Foreign Service, for example, consists of about 6,500 Foreign Service Generalist Officers, what are colloquially known as diplomats.
This is not just in Iraq. This is
worldwide.
Global.
This is worldwide. When you consider that you've got 50,000 troops there now, you get some sense of the order of magnitude. So this will have to be a very carefully managed process on our side to ensure that we don't get big gaps in capacity right when it's essential that we maintain our engagement.
Former Ambassador James Dobbins has described this new level of responsibility independent of the U.S. military as essentially unprecedented in scale. Talk about what the State Department will be doing now that has been handled by the military and by other entities up until this point.
Well, we've counted on the military for a lot of our political engagement, frankly, around the country, where we've had large numbers of soldiers stationed. And they will be continuing that engagement, certainly up until the end of 2011. But over that period, it's going to have to be handed off to the civilians. One of the key challenges is going to be the security dimension, because the civilian element has relied to a considerable extent on the U.S. military for security. So we're going to have to figure out a way to transition that to a civilian lead in a way that keeps our people safe, but just as important, keeps our people in a position to be active at a cost that that we can all afford. So just multiple challenges here as we move from military to civilian.
What kinds of functions will the satellite embassy offices set up in cities around Iraq perform now in conjunction with what's taking place in Baghdad?
When I was in Iraq, I presided over a dramatic increase in the civilian presence in satellite offices, what we called Provincial Reconstruction Teams, or PRTs. And at the height, we were up to 26 or 27 of those teams around the country. And they were very important as a tool of engagement for economic and social development in Iraq, to monitor political developments and to influence. Now, clearly we are cutting way down on those. Frankly, I think we're cutting down too far. But our satellite offices around the country will perform those functions. They will engage with Iraqis. They will provide assessments back to Baghdad and to Washington. They will be, again, a base for our economic and other development assistance. They will function and indeed will be, in many cases, U.S. consulates, a model familiar around the world, but like everything else, on a vastly greater scale in Iraq.
Has it been challenging, Ambassador, to find Foreign Service employees who are not only willing to serve but capable of serving effectively in Iraq?
The Foreign Service has been through a rough couple of decades in terms of resources. USAID, even more so. So clearly, to meet challenges like Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, we just need more people across the board. Both the previous administration and the current administration have fought hard for those resources with some success. I hope very much that Congress continues to protect funding, because you need more people, period. In terms of Iraq, I think it's very important that the Foreign Service continue to adopt what I call an expeditionary culture, that young men and women, when they join the Foreign Service, that they do so with the knowledge, the expectation, the desire to serve in the places where the challenges are greatest. That would be Iraq. I think you really have that with the post-9/11 generation of Foreign Service officers. But Foreign Service culture generally needs to continue to evolve in that direction. The expectation that you will be separated from your family, you will be in conditions of hardship and danger, because that's what makes a difference for the nation. We also need to do more on language skills.
I understand, by the way, this is a little bit off the track. You lived with a Bedouin nomadic tribe for some time while you were learning Arabic?
I did. My second year of Arabic studies was in Tunisia, and toward the end of that, in the spring, we had the opportunity to do field trips, and I chose to make my field trip a month-long sojourn with a clan of the Hawaitat tribe in southern Jordan. And it was a fascinating experience. I lived in the tents for that month, and I my day job was herding goats. I learned about 17 different words for goats and sheep, and I've always felt that I have a skill to fall back on if things don't work out for me in academia.
Doesn't pay quite as well, but I guess you really never have taken the easy route throughout your career.
Well, I've been privileged to be able to move into challenging places, really starting in Iraq more than 30 years ago. And I went on from there to Lebanon. I had two tours, 6 years altogether in Beirut, as well as my time in Baghdad, in Pakistan, and even in Afghanistan after 9/11. I would not, as difficult and at times as harrowing as those assignments have been, I would not trade a minute of it. Hugely rewarding experience to serve where it counts.
I want to go back for a minute to these 50,000 U.S. troops that remain in Iraq. Now, they're not called combat troops anymore, but as far as I can understand, their essential functions really haven't changed. They have different titles, but they're performing the same jobs. Is that correct?
Chris, that's exactly right. I think there have been some misimpressions of what August 31st and the remissioning of our forces in Iraq actually means. There's far more continuity here than change. We call them now advise and assist brigades. They, as the vice president said on the change of command from General Odierno to General Austin on September 1st, these are combat brigades. They are fully equipped, fully trained for combat operations. But again, August 31st was not a magic date. We have been transitioning out of a combat role now for months and months. Our forces are seldom involved in direct combat, but clearly we have the capability to do so if needed.
My guest this hour is Ryan Crocker. He is former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. He is currently dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker. He is currently Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. So some of the work that is being done by U.S. troops right now will ultimately be taken on by private contractors if things go as planned. How many contractors are planned to replace 50,000 U.S. troops?
I don't know the numbers, but the hard fact is the United States can't really go to war without contractors, and it can't build a peace without contractors. And those men and women who do contract work are dedicated patriots, just as those who work directly for the government or who soldier for our country. We have seen an increase in contracting. USAID, for example, now has about 20% of the officers worldwide that it had in Vietnam alone at the height of the CORDS program. So that means development work increasingly has to be done by contractors, that contracts that USAID administers. And I think this is a choice for the American government and the American people. Do we want to continue to proceed in that way, or do we want to rebuild an indigenous capacity in the government? And I would certainly favor the latter. I think we are starting to move in that direction, but for the interim, we are going to require literally thousands of civilian contractors to do development and other essential functions in Iraq.
Have they been unfairly maligned as a group?
Well, I think they have. Because of the horrific actions of a very small number of security contractors, contractors in general have, I think, come to be viewed with dislike and disdain in this country. And it's just flat wrong. I mean, I was out there with them. I have spoken at their memorials. They get killed just as dead as anyone who works for the government, and they're not out there doing it just for a paycheck. There really is a sense of commitment that I've found contractors at every level and in every line of work.
Let's talk about this power-sharing deal. U.S. leaders have been working very hard to convince Iraqis of the wisdom of power being shared between Nouri al-Maliki and Ayad Alawi. Talk about what the Iraqi perspective is on this deal and why, to them, it is not a solution that can work.
Well, we'll see what does work. Again, I think our people out there are being energetic, engaged, and very flexible in trying to nudge the Iraqis toward what will ultimately have to be an Iraqi solution. I think they'll get there, but it's a long, hard process. One of the reasons it's so hard is because of Iraq's history, both recent and not so recent. The horrors of the Saddam era, something we've largely forgotten about, are very much alive in the minds of Iraqis. That tends to breed a zero-sum mentality where a compromise on my part could be literally fatal down the road, mm-hmm. And that just makes this all the more difficult. There's a phrase, a pithy little phrase, two men, one grave. Translation is, it's you or me. So as they go through these debates, I think someone like Prime Minister Maliki has to consider, well, if he gives up power here, or even if he were to give up the prime ministry, could he literally survive in Iraq? Or would still embryonic institutions and imperfect rule of law literally be used to put him in his grave? So that's the environment we're dealing in, and that's why this is hard, and it's going to go on being hard.
What goals, if any, are shared and valued by Shiites and Sunnis and Kurds collectively?
First, that they never want to go back to a regime like the one that was overthrown in 2003.
Including the Sunnis.
Because the Sunni political establishment now all suffered hugely under the Saddam regime. The Iraqi Islamic Party, for example, of which Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi is a longtime member, was almost annihilated in Saddam's Iraq. So while they certainly don't want to see a Shia autocracy emerge and are concerned about that. Even less do they want to see a return to a Saddam-like regime. And again, Kurds, Sunni, Shia, I think all feel that way. They all cherish the notion of a democratic, pluralistic Iraq. They may differ on its actual structure. And among Arabs, nationalism, Iraqi identity, and a sense of patriotism is very profound. It was striking to me in the March election that figures from religious parties did not campaign on religious slogans. They were never mentioned, basically. Prime Minister al-Maliki, a member of the Shia religious Dawah party, talked about nationalism, Iraq's unique identity as Iraqis, and that resonates.
And you sense that that's more than just good politics on his part?
Well, it's the reason it's good politics on his part is because that's how Iraqis identify themselves. Even those with deep religious inclinations want to hear a nationalist message. And I think that's, again, it's an important and positive indicator for Iraq's future.
You were frustrated early on in the war that the U.S. failed to identify Sunnis who might be sort of brought into the fold earlier. What have the consequences been of that delay?
Well, I was out there in 2003 and worked to help form what we called the Governing Council, Iraq's first post-liberation governing body. And it was difficult to figure out who representative Sunni figures might be, particularly those who had never left Iraq. And it's still an evolving process. I think there is probably more fluidity and turbulence in the Sunni community over who its future leader should be than there is among the Shia and the Kurds. So it is going to be an evolving process. In terms of the insurgency we encountered, which was primarily a Sunni-led set of operations, I am not entirely convinced in my own mind that quicker identification of potential Sunni leaders would have entirely avoided that. In any case, it is still a work in progress.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq Ryan Crocker is my guest. Let's go on the phones now to Rick in Dallas. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make the comment about, I think one of the problems is that a lot of the oil's in the north, and the Kurds have control of that, and then a lot of the oil's in the south, and then there's a Sunni technocracy that ran the country in Baghdad, and it's going to really be hard to put that back together. And not usurp the resources as they have been taken away from them in the past. But the point I wanted to really make went back to the cost. And if we're going to keep thousands of our troops over there for years and years like we have in Korea, thousands of troops for 50 years, I wonder about the cost in blood and treasure, as the ambassador said. And I had always felt there were other geopolitical concerns besides WMD that we went in there for, namely that they do have 100 billion barrels of oil possibly not making it to the world market. And with the cost, I wonder, when are we going to get paid back? I mean, either in the form of lower oil prices, or when are the Iraqis going to shoulder the burden for the cost of this? We can't be the policemen for the world everywhere all the time.
Well, Rick, you've brought up lots of different points. Let's get a response for you. Thanks so much for your
call.
Thank
you.
Those were all excellent points from Rick. I would say on the issue of oil, the Constitution establishes that hydrocarbons are a national asset, and for all of the divisions within Iraqi society and governance, they've really observed that. Whether it's southern oil or northern oil, the proceeds all go into the national treasury, and they are distributed from the center in Baghdad in a manner that all parties find reasonably equitable. The Kurds, for example, get 17% of total oil revenues. The provinces all get a share based on population. So even with all of the unresolved issues in Iraqi governance, there is really no debate over hydrocarbons as a national asset and the entitlement of all Iraqis to a fair share of that asset, and that's important. In terms of Iraq's oil wealth and the financial burdens that that we have shouldered, increasingly the Iraqis are paying their own way. That's going on right now. And they, as they develop their oil industry with help from international oil companies, including American companies, we are going to see an expansion of production. We're going to see a major and, I think, reliable supplier on the market, which is good for consumers. What that will do to prices, I can't say over the long run, but clearly more supply is good. And in terms of burden sharing going forward, I think depending on what they ask of us and what we decide to do, that burden sharing is going to be a very fair topic of conversation.
We have an email here from GK in Dallas who asks, through the direct political, financial, and military control that Iran has over key Shiite parties and militias, can Iran effectively paralyze the Iraqi government, prevent it from being too pro-U.S. or anti-Iranian, and stir up sectarian strife at any time?
It's a great question, the role of Iran in Iraq. I think there is an assumption, not just in the U.S., but also in the region, that because a Shia majority in Iraq is now ascendant in the government, and because Iranians are Shia, that translates as Iranian control over much of Iraq. The reality is very different. Iraqi Shia are as passionately nationalistic as Sunnis in Iraq. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that those two countries fought a horrific eight-year war, 1980 to 1988, the Iraq-Iran War, that left millions dead on both sides and had combat operations that were analogous to the trench warfare of World War I. Neither people forget that, and there is a great reservoir of bitterness. So I think we can easily overestimate Iranian influence. The harder they push, in my experience there, the more the Iraqis pushed back. And one example involving the U.S. Was the two agreements that I negotiated in 2008. The Iranians were deeply opposed to the conclusion of these agreements, tried to obstruct them in every way possible. But again, the more they pushed against them, the more ready the Iraqis were to embrace the whole process, and that concluded with an overwhelming vote in the Iraqi parliament to ratify both agreements. So the Iranians can make a lot of bad things happen. They can be destructive. They have been in the past. I think they will try to do so in the future. But they absolutely cannot impose outcomes on the Iraqis. And the more they try, again, the more Iraqi resistance you're going to see.
Before the U.S. invasion in 2003, you prepared a report for then-Secretary of State Powell predicting that if Saddam Hussein were deposed, there would be this sort of surge of sectarian violence. I'm quite sure you're not at all happy to have been correct about that. Do you think that that was taken appropriately into account in planning for what would happen after Saddam Hussein was gone?
There was such a memo that we did send up toward the end of 2002. My colleagues and I were not trying to be predictive. We were trying to just be illustrative. Here are some of the things that could happen. Have we thought about those? Have we really worked our way through the consequences of an invasion? That we would prevail by force of arms was never in doubt. But what about the month after, the year after, the decade after? That's what we were trying to get out there for a serious discussion of consequences, foreseeable and unforeseeable. But, you know, that's the way it goes in diplomacy, as in other aspects of life. You take your best shot, make your best set of recommendations, and then you go forward. And in this case, as far as I know, that effort had no impact whatsoever.
It's got to be frustrating.
You learn to live with frustration.
A diplomatic answer, if ever I've heard one. We'll go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. I know you guys have already spoken about this before, so I hope you don't mind that I bring it back up again with the idea of the contractors. It's my personal opinion that the reason why the contractors are maligned is because with regard to the recent trials, particularly with Blackwater for their behavior, we don't, as citizens, have a real clear understanding about the accountability that these individuals in these companies have. I mean, for example, they don't seem to be falling under pure military jurisdiction and laws, and they certainly don't fall under pure civilian jurisdiction and laws, because, of course, we don't find ourselves in harm's way on a daily basis from a battlefield situation. So two questions for you. Number one, why isn't there clarity yet? Why hasn't this been made very clear to all of us as to how this works and how it will proceed from now on, not only in Iraq with the contractors, but with all of our foreign policy affairs? And then number two, what's your own personal opinion about how and how these contractors should be dealt with in terms of accountability? Thank you.
Tim, we've got to take a break right now, but we will get a response for you after that time. My guest this hour is former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker. He is currently Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is former U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon, Ryan Crocker. Currently, he is Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. We heard from Tim before the break, who wanted some more clarity and felt that the American people really don't fully understand the role of civilian contractors.
We talked earlier, of course, Chris, about that role. But Tim raises a great point. What are the legal structures that govern the behavior of U.S. contractors working for the U.S. government overseas? And I think he's right. I think there are some gaps there. We have yet to see, I think, a successful prosecution of a major crime that was not against Americans or American interests. We have had successful prosecutions on fraud and embezzlement of U.S. resources, but in terms of a crime involving Americans against Iraqi citizens, I'm not aware of a successful prosecution. There are lots of reasons for that, but I think that one of them is there are some legal gaps here. The role of contractors is relatively new for the United States, and I would hope that both the administration and Congress would take a careful look at cases that have been investigated but in which charges were not pressed, and determine if we need new legislation. And I kind of think we do. I think we are going to need to look at our whole criminal code to see if we're going to need some special provisions that will cover acts by U.S. contractors overseas against citizens of another country.
In 2007, when you testified before Congress, you characterized the Iraqi people as a traumatized society. To what extent are Americans, whether civilian contractors or members of the military, responsible for that? And to what extent does the blame lie with sectarian activists?
There is a lot of trauma in Iraq. The violence and the upheavals of the years since 2003 certainly play a part in that. I think the bulk of societal and individual trauma, though, goes back to the awful crimes of the Saddam era that, again, Americans just really don't have any consciousness of. Our own role in that, difficult to gauge, but I think that when you look at some of the polling data that I referred to earlier, when the very substantial majority of Iraqis are saying, Americans, please don't go, I think it's clear that whatever difficulties and problems there have been, Iraqis see us as part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Will we leave Iraq worse than we found it if, in fact, the withdrawal is complete by the end of 2011, as has been stated? Or will the fact that we removed Saddam Hussein guarantee that that much, at least, is better?
There are no guarantees in Iraq or in that part of the world generally. Again, developments over the last few years have been, I think, encouraging. Iraqis now are in the lead in looking after their own security. But as I said earlier, I think our engagement over the long term, military and civilian, is going to be important to see that Iraqis are able to consolidate these gains and not let it all slide back. Iraq today is arguably a better place, considerably a better place than it was under Saddam. Take something basic like power generation. For all of the shortages, there is far more power being generated today in Iraq than there was under Saddam. The demand is hugely greater. People can now get air conditioners and refrigerators and so forth. And that leads to black and brownouts that people complain about. But they didn't have those appliances in the pre-Saddam era. So in lots of ways, life is already better in Iraq. The challenge is for us to stay engaged and help Iraqis consolidate gains that I think are still uncertain.
Let's go next on the phones to Rob in Fort Worth. Hi, Rob.
Hey, guys. Great show today. Appreciate it. I was wondering, personally, when did you accept and acknowledge that there was actually no weapons of mass destruction, and how did that actually have any sort of impact in kind of, Iraqi political society when they actually realized that? And I'll take my answer off air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Rob. It was a painstaking process as American and other teams went through the country, through documentary records, and it took some time before the conclusion was reached that there were no weapons of mass destruction as far as we could ascertain. That was never a major issue within Iraq. Iraqis, by and large, whether it's 2003 or 2010, didn't care much about the WMD question. Their concerns were broader and, I think, in some respects, deeper. So while it was obviously very significant in U.S. political terms, almost did not register as an issue in Iraqi society.
Was it a blow to you as the highest-ranking representative of the U.S. government in Iraq?
Well, again, when I went out in 2003...
It was understood. Not 2003. Forgive me. Continue.
In 2003, my focus was on trying to bring some semblance of order to post-invasion chaos and work with the Iraqis on their initial governing structures. I didn't think much about WMD. And by 2007, when I got there at the beginning of 2007, with Iraq basically in a state of civil war, WMD wasn't on my radar then either. It was all about what can we do to start to reverse this this tide of violence and chaos. So with the vast and deep agenda of things I had to worry about day and night, WMD was something for somebody else to deliberate, not for me.
Was that phrase, civil war, a larger political hot potato in this country than it ever was in Iraq?
I think it is, or was. We tend to get caught up with labels that may or may not be an accurate depiction of reality. The Iraqis, of course, are contending with the reality. And I don't remember Iraqis spending much time debating whether or not there was an actual civil war going on. They were concerned about living through the violence that was all around them and finding a way to bring a stop to it, whatever you called it.
What obligation do you think the United States has to the, I think the number is 2 million Iraqis who are estimated to have been displaced from the country and are living in other places now?
I think we have obligations on several levels. Most fundamentally, we have a major obligation to assist those Iraqis who served us in some way. When I got to Iraq in 2007, just a little over 1,000 Iraqis were being admitted every year to the U.S., and I found that, frankly, unconscionable. And I worked very hard with some success to get processes in place, to get political commitments in Washington to dramatically increase those numbers. And I think we're up to somewhere north of 17,000 a year. And that is as it should be. We have always been a refuge for those who've had to flee their homeland for whatever reasons. And I think we are doing the right and responsible thing now. But as you note, there are several million refugees. And what we have been engaged in and need to continue to engage in, I think, are two broad areas. First, ensuring that they have the resources from the international community to live decent lives while they're outside of Iraq. Second, to work with the Iraqi government, with the United Nations and other nations and international agencies to create the conditions and the support for their eventual return. And that was, again, a high priority of mine while I was there. We concentrated first on internally displaced persons, those who had not left Iraq, just moved from one part to another, and as they successfully returned home to then make a bigger effort on the refugee population outside of Iraq's borders.
I'm going to ask you to generalize here, but is repatriation typically the goal of people who have moved overseas?
I think it varies from nationality to nationality, and obviously depends on circumstances. Iraqis in the region are kind of known for having a pretty fierce attachment to their country. They don't really expatriate that easily or that well. And I think the substantial majority of Iraqis who were forced to leave the country would like to return if conditions will permit. And that's not just security conditions, it's also economic conditions, that they are able to get jobs. By and large, Iraqis are deeply attached to their country, and I think that holds out the prospect that as conditions continue to improve, you will see substantial numbers of them return.
We have time for one more quick call here, and that will be Brett in Louisville. Hi, Brett.
Hey, how you doing, Chris?
Great, thank you.
Great show. I have a quick question, and it's in regards to this disbanding of the Iraqi military, and I'm just curious about how you feel about that and how you feel that's impacting us today. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Great question, Brett. I was there again in May of 2003 when some of these decisions were taken. We didn't disband the Iraqi military. It disbanded itself. In the face of our invasion, Iraqi soldiers just simply left their duty stations in many cases. So we would have had to reconstitute Saddam's army if that's what we wanted to do. And if we had done that, my considered opinion is we would have had a far greater insurrection on our hands than we eventually faced with the Sunni insurgency. I think we would have seen the Shia, for example, find such a step totally unacceptable given what that army had done to them. So, again, it's a complex situation. I think we would have made a horrible mistake to stand that army up again. But I think there were other mistakes, and two of them that did have an impact, I think, after 2003, were first not moving quickly enough to build up a new Iraqi security force, and second, not moving quickly or broadly enough to pay pensions to former members of the old force.
I have always been curious about the transition process from one ambassador to another, particularly in a place as fraught and as important as Iraq. Can you describe the process for us a little bit?
The Foreign Service or diplomacy has its own traditions, and one of them is you never have two ambassadors in the same country at the same time. So while the military does a change of command that has both commanders present, ambassadors never do.
No overlap.
No overlap. For example, I arrived in March of 2007, about 48 hours after Ambassador Khalilzad had left. But we had had extensive communication and connection before that. And I, with his permission, I was working very closely with his staff while I was still in Pakistan before I got out to Baghdad with video conferences, an exchange of memoranda, and so forth. So a lot of interaction goes on between incoming and outgoing ambassadors. And particularly between the incoming ambassador and the embassy staff that's already present.
And does that communication continue after the next ambassador is in place? Are you sort of on speed dial, or were you for Ambassador Hill?
You're always there to be consulted, but again, only one ambassador at a time. And when you have that responsibility and that authority, I think the American government and the American people expect you to use it. So you're there for a reason, so you need to be acting like an ambassador from day one.
Brian Crocker is Dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Kuwait, and Lebanon. Ambassador Crocker, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.